The subject of Jerusalem is so vast, but just to begin with, I'd like to tell you where I'm coming from. I'm an Iraqi Jew, born in Bombay, India, and raised in a very Zionist community where Israel and Judaism were almost inextricable. Our whole life, our whole community life, revolved around Israel and in the celebration of the festivals and the Sabbath. And generally, we joined youth movements that were geared towards Israel and linked to other countries like South Africa, modeled on sort of almost a militaristic scout type of movement, you know, geared towards Israel. I also come from a practicing Orthodox family, and so Jerusalem and Israel are very intrinsic, as I say, to our celebrations. In Passover, for instance, where we celebrated the liberation of the Jews from Pharaoh's Egypt, led into Israel, so that at the Seder table, the celebration, we always used to invoke the cry, next year in Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is very much part of the Jewish culture and religion. And in fact, Jerusalem is really a universal symbol for all three religions and symbolizes almost what a really real peace, a utopia and paradise of peace should be. And instead of that, it is the heart of real conflict. It was only later in my teens, after visiting Israel and meeting with Palestinians, that I became aware of a different narrative. Of course, I was very pro-Israel and pro-Zionist to the one that I had been inculcated with. And I met my wife, in fact, in Israel when I was a young student architect working in an Israeli architect's office. In fact, the architect, later I realized, who was given the task, in fact, of building an Israeli state after 1948 over the destruction of 560 Palestinian villages. It's something that was not in the narrative as we, you know, were taught. We were taught that Israel had to get back to the promised land, the Jews had to get back to the promised land, especially after the Holocaust. And the Arabs just left, you know, the Arab countries all wanted to attack Israel because they didn't want a Jewish homeland, and they just upped and left. And this was the sort of narrative that we were given. And it's only when I actually visited Israel, worked there, met with Palestinians, that I realized that there was a different narrative. I met Palestinians because I was taught that the Palestinians who were left in Israel had total freedom. They were citizens of Israel. They had the same democratic rights. But I soon realized from talking to Palestinians that this wasn't so. They were limited in their movement. They couldn't move around the country and, in fact, were considered a fifth column. This was after the formation of the State of Israel. And unfortunately, what's happening today is, in fact, that they're still being considered the fifth column. And in fact, what is happening in Israel is a continuation of the Nakba, the 1948 war, and the terrible disaster that befell the Palestinians. So while the State of Israel was being built, the Palestinians, who were the indigenous population, who had to be displaced to form the Zionist state, actually are still in the same position today. Now, Jerusalem is actually the crux of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And whatever happens in Jerusalem affects any resolution to the conflict. I'd just like to read why Jerusalem is actually important to the three religions, and there are three very well-known quotations that I think are very apt for a festival at Greenbelt. The three religions. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my highest joys. And you may recognize that as Psalm 137, the song of the exiled children of Israel sung by the waters of Babylon. And this, of course, you will also recognize. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and yet you would not. That was Jesus contemplating Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, Matthew 23:37. And the third quotation is actually from the Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. O Jerusalem, the choice of Allah of all his lands, in it are the chosen of his servants. From it the earth was stretched forth, and from it shall it be rolled up like a scroll. The dew which descends upon Jerusalem is a remedy from every sickness, because it is from the gardens of paradise. So as you see, Jerusalem is so important to the three religions, and over the centuries has been fought over, and it's changed hands. But at the moment, it's in Israel's hands, and the intention in by Israel, as you may have sort of seen over the decades, is to take over the whole of Jerusalem. It's not only Jerusalem, but the whole of original Palestine, leaving a few enclaves or cantons for the Palestinian population. Israel achieves its objectives by limiting or removing Palestinians both in West Jerusalem, that's West Jerusalem, which 40% of which was Palestinian and Arab before the foundation of the state, and to deny the Palestinians their capital. So the idea of Jerusalem, of the Israelis, is to create a majority Jewish population by transferring or removing or limiting the Palestinian population. And this is the intention that we have seen being revealed over the last few decades. You cannot talk about Jerusalem without talking about the history of the foundation of the State of Israel and the international law regarding Jerusalem. Jerusalem, as you know, was supposed to be a corpus separatum under the 1947 partition of the state of Palestine. Jerusalem was meant to be a city for the three religions, knowing how contentious it was. It was meant to be a city that was to be under the guise of the United Nations, and with the declaration of the establishment of the State of Israel and the subsequent invasion by surrounding the Arab armies. I just want to go into the corpus. In November 1947, the United Nations General Assembly adopted Resolution 181, which called for the partition of Palestine into an Arab and Jewish state, with Jerusalem being established as a separated body, a corpus separatum, with a special legal and political status administered by the United Nations and separate from both states named in the 1947 plan. Apparently, the Jews were not... The war of 1948 actually changed the whole picture, and of course, from the 53% that Israel, the Israeli state, was allotted, Israel, in fact, captured 78% of the whole of Palestine. And we had the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza. Now, the important thing to remember about Jerusalem is that Israel now, right through the years, has considered that Jerusalem will be an undivided Jewish city. And in fact, East Jerusalem's status under international law, as understood by every country besides Israel, is that it is occupied territory. That is very important to understand. Jerusalem, not only the West Bank, but Jerusalem and the surroundings are occupied territory. And of course, Israel considers it an undivided capital. And in fact, the strangest thing is that President Obama, when he was addressing the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in the United States, which is this very powerful Jewish lobby, it's a Zionist, pro-Zionist lobby in the United States, Obama said that Jerusalem shall remain an undivided city. Now, that was very wrong because it is not recognized as an undivided city. It was meant to be a shared capital, with West Jerusalem being under Israeli control and East Jerusalem under Palestinian control. But after the 1967 war, Israel took over the whole of Jerusalem and immediately said that this would remain an undivided Jewish city. And in every peace agreement, the Israelis have insisted, whatever the political status of the negotiator or a political party at the time, have always recognized or have always asserted that Jerusalem will be an undivided capital. And this is, in fact, what has led to the terrible conflict over the years. Now, now the whole point of Israel's position in Jerusalem is that it's not only against international law, but it is also against the Geneva Convention. And although settlements, all the settlements in the West Bank are all illegal, whatever Israel has built in Jerusalem, the towns and the cities that have been built in the West Bank and the settlements in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem, are all illegal, whatever Israel says. So just remember that. And in May 2001, the head of the International Red Cross delegation to Israel and the occupied territories said that settlements are equal in principle to war crimes. The transfer, the installation of the population of the occupying power into the occupied territories is considered as an illegal move and qualified as a grave breach. It's a grave breach, formally speaking, but grave breaches are equal in principles to war crimes. Now, this was said by René Kosimek, the head of the ICRC, the International Red Cross delegation to Israel, in May 2001. So, in fact, not only is it against international law, but it is actually a war crime to build illegal settlements. So that is a very important factor. And in fact, anyone participating in a war crime is also liable to be, participating in it. And we've all heard of universal jurisdiction, you know, where Israeli ministers or generals arriving in London or abroad who have participated in wars, like in the wars of Gaza, the recent attack on Gaza, are actually committing war crimes. And you can actually arrest any general or any minister who was responsible for a war that created the war crimes. So on that basis, for instance, the mayor of Jerusalem earlier this year came to London, you know, to Chatham House, to give a talk on his modern vision for Jerusalem. We felt, you know, that he should have actually been arrested for war crimes. So that's a very important point to consider. Now, considering Jerusalem, you cannot consider it without the planning of Jerusalem. As an architect, we're very interested. Our group called Architects and Planners for Justice in Palestine are interested in the whole aspect of how architecture and planning create the occupation. The occupation is the settlement towns, the whole mattress of control, the wall that is being built, the separation wall that is being built within the West Bank to separate Palestinian communities, the whole matrix of control. Now, the whole of the West Bank has a network of roads that separate the two communities. the main roads, the highways that drive right through, joining Israel to the West Bank, are for Israelis only, for the settlers only. And Palestinians are not allowed to travel on these roads. Now, these roads indicate the separation of the two communities and the separate conditions, the separate roads, create an apartheid situation. So when people say, you know, Israel is an apartheid state, it doesn't exactly mean that it's exactly South Africa, but where you separate two communities, you have separate facilities, separate roads, and you treat the two communities in a totally different way. You have different laws for one, different laws for the other. It is creating the situation of an apartheid state. And of course, you've all heard of the checkpoints. From one town to another, Palestinians have to pass through checkpoints. And anyone who's visited Palestine, and I know there are people in the audience, probably have experienced what it is like for a Palestinian to get from one village to the other, from one area to the other. The whole idea is to separate the Palestinians into cantons. And the way that Jerusalem and the settlements have been planned, which are built on very strategic hilltops, is to dominate the Palestinian villages, to take over their land, to literally steal their land, because most of the settlements are built on expropriated, stolen land from the Palestinians. Now, in terms of actual planning, we as architects respond, you know, to the way that Jerusalem is being planned. I'd like to read to you a description of the way Jerusalem has evolved and how it is being planned today. When Israel talks about an undivided city, it doesn't only mean the old city of Jerusalem or the small area of Jerusalem. What Israel has done as this Palestinian professor named Sari Makdisi, who is actually a literature professor in Los Angeles, describes it like this. Nowhere is the nature of the Israeli project to assert total territorial control of the external spaces in the West Bank more evident than in and around Jerusalem. Jerusalem, like Israel itself, is not a stable concept. It is not one place fixed in space and time. Where Jerusalem is, where it begins and ends, how much land it encompasses, who is counted as a resident, who is excluded, these have all proved unstable and shifting variables. This is one reason why hardly any country, including the United States, recognizes Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Almost all nations, again, including the United States, maintain their Israeli embassies not in Jerusalem, but rather in Tel Aviv. Jerusalem was divided during and after the war in 1948, during which Israel was created. When the fighting ended, the western part of the city had fallen under Israeli control. The eastern part, along with the rest of the West Bank, had ended up under Jordanian control. At that time, what was called East Jerusalem amounted to the area of the old city and a few outlying neighborhoods, totaling a little over 2 square miles. After the 1967 war, during which Israel captured East Jerusalem and the West Bank, the Israelis expanded the territorial dimensions of what they called Jerusalem by adding almost 27 square miles of West Bank land to the city's municipal borders. In 1980, they also claimed to annex it under Israeli law to the land of Israel. In fact, over 90% of the eastern part of what the official Israeli slogan refers to as the eternal and undivided capital of the Jewish people actually consists of land thus added to Jerusalem after 1967. According to international law, this land, like the original 2 square miles of post-1948 East Jerusalem itself, part of the West Bank, or in other words, militarily occupied territory, not subject to unilateral annexation. Now, the United Nations have insisted over the years, and even the EU commissions that have visited Israel have said that East Jerusalem is not part of Israel. Now, having claimed to annex it, Israel not only refuses to acknowledge that East Jerusalem is occupied territory, it treats it as though it were its sovereign territory, which legally it is not. For example, immediately following the Annapolis summit in November 2007, which was supposed to have relaunched the peace process, Israel announced plans to construct hundreds of new housing units in one of its East Jerusalem settlements, Har Homa, thereby expanding it. Now, as soon as after 1967, Israel began building all around East Jerusalem a sort of ring of settlements in order to cut Jerusalem off from the West Bank. And the Israeli attempt to incorporate, the whole idea was to incorporate Arab land without the Arabs. Now, the boundaries of Jerusalem extended to outlying Palestinian towns. If you look at the plan, the metropolitan plan for Jerusalem today, it's like a sort of an octopus. It's tentacles that stretch right into the West Bank, and each settlement is expanded to join with other settlements to prevent the Palestinians of East Jerusalem, which is the heart of the West Bank and the heart of their whole culture and link to all the Palestinian towns, is cut off from the West Bank and geared and, sort of taken over by Israel, considered as part of Israel. And this extends right sort of north towards Ramallah, which is like a sort of almost an extension of Jerusalem, and south to Bethlehem. And the wall, the terrible separation barrier, is now sort of traces its map, its plan, right around the extended metropolitan area of Jerusalem. So when Israel says, we want Jerusalem as an undivided city, it's really a whole chunk and a whole section of the West Bank, 200,000 of the Israeli settlers actually are in settlements around Jerusalem itself. And the settlements itself, the settlement towns themselves have a population of the remaining 300,000. So altogether, you've got 500,000 settlers that are illegal around the whole West Bank and Jerusalem, 200,000 of which are in East Jerusalem itself. So now we've discovered how Israel is trying to expand its territory, even so far as sort of settlement towns that stretch almost to Jericho. Now, Jerusalem stretches in its Israeli form to a city called Ma'ale Adumim. You may have heard of the settlement of Ma'ale Adumim, which is one of the largest settlement towns that is built at nearly up to Jericho, cutting the West Bank in half. And what Israel is now doing is creating a sort of a mega city, joining Ma'ale Adumim to West Jerusalem, to East Jerusalem, and there's an area in between that actually would have been the link from the northern West Bank to the southern West Bank, but Israel is now wanting to close that off as well in an area called E1, which is, they have all the plans ready to build it, but the West has said, this must never be built. And as you know, as much as the Western powers have said, please, don't build illegal settlements, stop it. Obama and Hillary Clinton have said any expansion of settlements is, not helpful. Israel, as you know, never heeds to any of this. They just continue in their own way and with the determination to expand and control and take over literally the whole of Jerusalem, extending into the West Bank and exercising total control over the Palestinian lives and literally every single Palestinian is on a population register that Israel has. So even the Palestinians in Gaza are controlled by Israel. You cannot get from one area to another without permission. Now, as you know, the West Bank is divided into three sections, areas A, B, and C. This was under, in 1993, under the Oslo Peace Accord. Israel, the West Bank was divided into three sections. This was the agreement that the Israelis insisted on. There were areas A, B, and C. Area A was under total Israeli control, under Palestinian control. Area B was under Palestinian-Israeli control. And Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank, including the Jordan Valley, was to be under Israeli control. And in effect, what Israel is doing now, they were supposed to have evacuated Area C, which was 60% of the West Bank, in 2 years' time. It was only supposed to be a temporary control of that area, but two decades later, Israel is still in control, and it actually considers Area C as if it was part of Israel. Any Palestinian building in the Area C of the West Bank, any house is demolished. And in the Jordan Valley recently, Israel has more or less totally annexed the Jordan Valley. And any Palestinian town, any village, any agricultural land is now being taken over. There have been terrible stories of demolitions. And I want to come out onto the subject of house demolitions, which is really what is actually happening now in East Jerusalem. Now, in terms of... Now, as you know, the city of Jerusalem is controlled by Israel. You've got the Temple Mount, which is the Arab Haram al-Sharif. It's the holy mount where Muhammad was supposed to have ascended to heaven. And they've got the holiest shrines and mosques there. There's the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, you know, which is the main praying area. Now, this is the same area that was supposed to have been where the Temple of Solomon was built. And what is happening now is, at the moment, the Arab Waqf, which is the organization, the spiritual organization of the Arab councils, actually are supposed to be administering the Temple Mount, the Haram al-Sharif. And Palestinians and Arabs are supposed to have complete access to their, you know, to their holy sites and their holy, you know, areas of worship. Now, in fact, that is not the case. Israel controls the whole city, all the Arab areas, and only allows Palestinians who are over the age of 50 to go and pray in their holiest city. So there are these terrible tensions now because you've got various Israeli settler groups who are determined to rebuild the Temple of Solomon on the Temple Mount. And there's terrific conflict now as to who actually administers the holy sites. Now, you've all heard about the terrible house demolitions. Linda here mentioned the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Now, there are many Israeli NGOs who are trying to end Israel's policy of house demolitions. Now, in planning terms, Palestinians who want to build on their own land in East Jerusalem are not allowed to build. They're not given permission to build. And under Israeli law, Israel has now prevented Palestinians from actually building or extending their houses. They have no permission to build at all. And instead, because the Palestinian families are forced to build illegally, Israel says, oh, they're illegally built, and they start demolishing these houses. Now, under the Geneva Convention, occupying powers are prohibited from destroying property or employing collective punishment. Article 53 of the Geneva Convention reads, any destruction by the occupying power or real or personal property belonging individually or collectively to private persons is prohibited. Under this provision, the practice of demolishing Palestinian houses is banned, as is the wholesale destruction of the Palestinian infrastructure. Yet since 2000 to since the year 2000 to January 2010, 1,010 housing units were demolished in East Jerusalem. And since 1967, 24,000 Palestinian houses have been destroyed in East Jerusalem. The whole idea is never to give Palestinians a chance, you know, to establish a hold or a claim to Jerusalem itself. And despite international anger, these house demolitions continue. Now, in planning terms, planners, if you want to create a project, a planning project to build a house, you've got to submit plans showing how you will bring in the roads and the services and the infrastructure. And what happens is that the Palestinian sections in East Jerusalem are denied, even though they pay taxes. They're considered as residents of East Jerusalem. Even though they pay taxes, they're not given the same services and infrastructure that are given to the Jewish areas of Jerusalem. And because of this, you know, these areas are in a terrible state. And Israel says, oh, look at them, you know, these places are, you know, they're all slummy and, you know, they're terrible and we need to demolish them. But in fact, they're not given the same services, the municipal services, for the taxes that are paid to, you know, improve their areas. Now, what is happening is the Israeli state, if it wants to build a project, can create the housing ministry has their own planning department that actually pays and builds and plans these projects that actually take over Palestinian property and Palestinian land. Now, in the whole idea is that they want to extend the Jewish area of the old city. After the 67 war, you know, as you know, the old city is divided into four sections. There's the Muslim area, there's the Muslim quarter, the Jewish quarter, the Armenian quarter, and the Christian quarter, where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is located. Now, around Jerusalem, there's some very important areas that Israel has its claim to. And they use settler organizations, the extreme religious settlers, who are the ones that originated the settlements from the West Bank, now laying their claim to areas of the city below the old city, places like Silwan, which were supposed to be where King David had his city. And they've got two very contentious plans in Silwan where they want to take over the existing cities, sections of Silwan that are populated by Palestinians, and move Jewish settlers into these areas. And this is a very common thing within Israel itself. They literally want to move religious settlers into Arab sections of, you know, cities in Israel like Haifa, like Jaffa, like Acre, and to displace and remove the Palestinian population, and no more than in the city of Jerusalem. Silwan is where it is reputed the city of David was built. And there are two very contentious areas. One is what is called the City of David, which is a very important archaeological site that was excavated through the Mandate which consisted of all the tunnels and the water channels built by the Canaanites and extended through the biblical history, that is now being taken over by a settler group called El Ad, which is specifically to create the city of David. And now this is in a Palestinian area in Silwan. And there are terrible battles. There's a terrible brutality, almost a reign of terror on the Palestinians in that area. So what is happening is that soldiers and police go in and terrorize the Jewish the Palestinian population. And recently, soldiers and police shot and injured Palestinians, blocked all roads. And they're really using extreme force, which is the method that Israel has used, you know, to occupy the whole West Bank, using terrible police force, violence, to control and to take over the Palestinian property. In Silwan itself, we are in touch with a lot of the the community in Silwan. The question is, how much longer will it? You've also heard of Sheikh Jarrah, where Palestinians literally are being removed from their houses. And Sheikh Jarrah was an area in East Jerusalem where Jews had lived in the end of the 19th century. And on the basis of that, religious settlers, who are actually many from the United States, say, oh, that is Jewish property. We want to now take this over. We have the right to take it over. So they literally evict Palestinians out of these houses that were given after they'd become refugees after 1948 and were given these houses by the Jordanians. And the most terrible scenes of people being evicted, families being thrown out of their houses, and religious settlers going in to occupy them. And this is what is happening right throughout Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. And the question is, how much longer will it be possible to maintain a situation in which Jews will have the right to demand ownership of Jewish property that has been left on the eastern side of the Green Line, while the Arabs are forbidden to demand rights of ownership to their property that has been left on the western side of that same line? After the 1948 war, 40% of West Jerusalem was actually Palestinian, and wonderful houses, you know, that were evicted, the Palestinians had to run away because of the approaching Israeli army, were taken over by Jews who were coming in from Europe, Jews that had actually had to leave the Jewish quarter from Jerusalem, and were taken over. Now, Jews are claiming property that could have been owned by Jews in East Jerusalem, but yet are not allowing property that Palestinians occupied in West Jerusalem from being given back. So they're totally different conditions for the two. Right. I don't know whether I've made much sense there, but what's happening now is to talk a little bit more about the these two areas in Silwan. One is called the King David, the City of David. The other is the King's Garden, where David, these are just below the old city, where the settlers want to extend the Jewish quarter of the old city and give it the same sort of biblical character that they've created in the old city, in south of the old city on the valleys below. And the vision is to restore the gardens of King David and Solomon to what it was 3,000 years ago. And as a lot of the NGOs have said, this is a dangerous nationalist fantasy. There are no such archaeological findings in the area, because at the moment what's happening is the settlers are tunneling under the Palestinian neighborhoods in Silwan, trying to discover evidence of the city of David, of which there's very little evidence that it actually did exist. Even though King David may have been in the area, the exact location is not actually being pinpointed. And yet, the El Ard settlers are determined to tunnel under houses where Palestinians are living to reach the Temple Mount. You know, they're determined to find a sort of tunneling route. And as you know, the Israelis are very keen to bomb tunnels in Gaza that are the lifeline for people, you know, wanting to supply, you know, important things, for, you know, to because of the blockade that are needed by the people. And yet, the Israelis are very keen to build, to dig these tunnels around and under Jerusalem. So right around the old city, there are various tunnels that link sort of historical sites that are put under the authority of settler organizations that are not actually, it's not archaeological, according to the principles of archaeology, they've got to be, archaeology has got to be done in a very principled way where you've got to dig down in layers. But what's happening is that the settlers are digging through horizontally, destroying any evidence of any other civilization, any other Islamic buildings that may they come across, but all they're interested in is in evidence of, you know, the Jewish part of the Bible. So they want to erase the character of the, or any evidence of any other civilization, but just, you know, sort of reveal evidence of Jewish or biblical nature that, you know, gives the claim of Israel to the Holy Land. And this is the whole essence of Israeli archaeology today, which is against the principle and against UNESCO's ideals, you know, that any occupying power cannot destroy, you know, the evidence of... and there's a lot of things being, you know, sort of pamphlets actually being written about the sort of cultural genocide, you know, that is actually going on in Jerusalem. And genocide is not only getting rid of another population, it is actually destroying and erasing another person's culture. And this has been the aim in archaeology. For instance, in just after the 1967 war, Israel extended what was the Jewish quarter to five times its original size, and it was immediately declared an archaeological site. It was a massive site where they dug under and, you know, right across the old city. And if you go to Jerusalem today, if you don't know that what we see now are museums of various priests and, you know, that were actually linked just to the sort of Jewish history, but a lot of evidence, for instance, where the Wailing Wall is today, a whole area which was the Moroccan quarter, the Mughrabi quarter, which was 400 years old, containing a lot of very precious Islamic archaeology, was actually destroyed by Israel immediately after the 67 war. In fact, the chief rabbi wanted to destroy the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, but he was just prevented, you know, by one of the politicians there. They thought that that would be too inflammatory. But in fact, what's happening today is a slow destruction of Palestinian, the population taking over their land and taking over, you know, the whole and erasing the history of Palestine and Islamic civilization. And this is also happening in West Jerusalem itself. You may have heard of the Museum of Tolerance that is being built in West Jerusalem on the site of a Muslim cemetery. It's called Mamilla Cemetery, which was an ancient... It's like what the Mount of Olives is to the Jewish heritage. The Mamilla Cemetery in West Jerusalem is the same to, you know, the Muslim heritage. Their prophets, descendants of the prophets Muhammad, are buried there. And what is happening now is that a rabbi who has run the Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, where they have built a museum of tolerance, which is supposed to be for interfaith tolerance, are now intending to build the Museum of Tolerance in West Jerusalem on the site of this ancient Muslim cemetery. They're in the process of actually destroying and removing these graves in the middle of the night. You know, 15,000 graves in this latest episode are now being removed without, sort of anyone being able to see it. It has raised a terrible outcry, but they're determined to follow this through. And in fact, this Rabbi here, has now actually protested against the mosque, the Muslim center that they're intending to build near Ground Zero. You may have heard of the Muslim center, religious center, that is just a couple of blocks away from Ground Zero. And the same rabbi who wants to build the Museum of Tolerance on a cemetery in Jerusalem says, oh no, we can't allow this mosque near Ground Zero because it's on a cemetery. So it's exactly the same thing. And this is the two different, methods that they have. I don't know whether I'd like to, how am I for time?
5 minutes, so if you want.
Is that all?
Yeah.
Oh, have I really taken as long as that? Oh, I'm so sorry. I just wanted to come along, how will we actually achieve peace? We've got these talks now that are starting that are supposed to be starting in the States, and where the two leaders are supposed to be, the Palestinian and Israeli leaders. Now, we've got to know who the protagonists are. We've got Netanyahu as this extreme right-wing politician who's a descendant of the terrorists who actually blew up the King David Hotel, just before 1948. These are the Israeli terrorists of the Irgun who blew up, executed British soldiers, who blew up the King David Hotel, who actually were the extreme wing of the Israeli, defense forces, are now, the descendants of these are actually now in power, the extreme rightist groups. And they're the ones that are going to be carrying out the peace talks. And they've said, Netanyahu has said, that they want to carry these talks out without preconditions. Now, this has been actually echoed by Hillary Clinton, who said that, who agreed that one of the terms is that they should be carried out without preconditions. And yet, he said that Jerusalem is going to be an undivided capital and that the Palestinians must recognize Israel as a Jewish state, which means it's negating, their own origins in an area that was theirs before. And it also means eradicating the international law resolution 242, where Israel was meant to withdraw, to the original boundaries of, the 1948 war. And as the peace talks were being announced, Netanyahu approved the installation of 23 mobile classrooms in several settlements around the West Bank. And it really should, resolution 242 should have been the basis of these peace talks, and yet they're saying it's without preconditions. And as you see, the West usually buckle under, to what Israel wants. And this is one of the bases that we have got to recognize, is that Israel carries out, is able to act with total impunity because it is, supported by the West. It is part of the whole sort of Western imperialist policies, that control, the Middle East, and it's an outpost for the West. So this is why Israel is allowed to get away, with all the terrible injustices and, human rights infringements. I think I'll stop there, and if there are any questions, I don't know whether that's... Yeah. Okay.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we know that some of you may need to go on to another talk now. We've been told that the next speaker will be starting here at 5:30. That means we can still use this space for some question and answers. So those of you that do need to go, please feel free to leave now. But if there are some folks with questions, we can remain here and Abe can answer some of these.
Hello. Hi. Yes, I just wondered if Abe would like to comment with his sort of planning hat on the role of Veolia around Jerusalem. You know, we're familiar with Veolia as a company that goes around collecting our rubbish and cleaning the streets. It's a big European company, but it has other roles too, and it's building this light railway, which is going to link all those illegal settlements all around East Jerusalem out towards Jericho. So I believe that in this country, some local authorities who have used Veolia in the past, they've decided to boycott now, I think, Edinburgh, Swansea, because of their role in this, as you've described it, war crimes. Yeah. And I think it's important to take this message that we can't intervene directly in what Israel is doing, but indirectly we can call for the boycott of companies that are benefiting from this occupation.
Yes, Veolia is the French company that actually is building a light railway that connects West Jerusalem to some of the settlements in East Jerusalem. And although they declare that this will be a railway, it's a light railway that will be used by both Palestinians and Israelis, it is very clear that it is just really to connect Israeli settlements. And in fact, a survey, they asked the local population in their survey, would they mind if Palestinians use this railway, were allowed to use the railway? I mean, who conducts a survey asking people if another community, you know, should be allowed to? If it's genuinely for everybody, why, you know, sort of create a situation like this and ask people, you know, would you mind sharing this? It's like, you know, sort of white people being asked, would you mind if a black person, you know, use bus 47? So it's illegal under international law. And even the OECD, which Israel has recently been allowed to join, one of the very specific elements is that no country can carry out anything that breaches international law, create any projects, you know, that breach international law, to be allowed to join the OECD. And yet Israel has been allowed has been welcomed with open arms. So it's one of the areas that we over here can actually take some action, you know, in writing to your local authorities who have contracts, you know, cleaning contracts with Veolia, you know, to say that, you know, they are breaching international law. Why should they be allowed, you know, to, you know, benefit from local authority contracts? And a lot of this we will discuss, you know, in the boycott panel, the panel discussing the boycott on Monday.
Hello. I wonder if you could tell me, or tell us a little bit about the incentives for particularly American Jews and others to be living in the settlements. I gather there are kind of financial benefits for them and sort of arrangements made for them to have all sorts of deals to encourage them to live there.
Yes, the whole point is that most of the settlements are actually not the people who live there aren't actually the nationalist settlers who originally set up the settlements. They're sort of Israelis in general who are offered fantastic benefits. First of all, the houses are about half the price that you'd pay within Israel itself, with wonderful sort of facilities, swimming pools and wonderful parks and gardens, and which actually gives Israelis who want to live in something, you know, much cheaper, but yet linked very directly to Israel itself. You know, the highways that are built, you can go from Ma'ale Adumim, for instance, into Jerusalem within sort of 20 minutes, using sort of separated highways that go through tunnels or over bridges where you don't see a Palestinian. you can actually live in a settlement, and you know, because Palestinians have separate roads, you can travel from as if it's part of Israel itself. And most of the major settlements, like Ariel, for instance, are linked to cities and, you know, like Tel Aviv, through these highways. So it is very beneficial. So if you're working in Tel Aviv, for instance, it would only take about, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour to get into the West Bank. So, you know, conditions are wonderful. You get, you know, wonderful sort of spatial standards, wonderful views, you know. In fact, you see Palestine. In fact, they've said that the settlers consider that God is their estate agent, actually. And so there are, you know, great benefits to living. But, of course, it's all illegal. And this is something that has got to be got across, you know, to them. Anything else?
If the Palestine houses are being knocked down, where are the Palestinians living? Are they moving out the areas? So does that mean in that particular area, the Palestine population is reducing?
Well, that's the whole point. The idea is to transfer them out. This has been the aim of Zionism, was literally to take over the whole of Eretz, what was called Eretz Israel, from Jordan, the River Jordan, to the Mediterranean Sea. And what often happens is with the Palestinians who evicted, they literally they become homeless. And previously they were refugees. And sometimes they're made homeless over and over again. And at the most, they're given a tent to live in, or they move in with other, you know, extended family, which means, you know, they're overcrowded. For instance, there have been no projects to actually build or expand Palestinian communities. While Israel has built 1,000 new cities and towns, there has not been a single Palestinian town built. And the Palestinian communities, both within Israel and in the West Bank, have remained, they're limited to the areas that they were, that they occupied in 1948. So while Israel has expanded to, you know, as much land as possible, Palestinians are being constricted, you know, to very, very limited areas. And this is happening right throughout Israel itself, in the Negev, the vast desert. Bedouin are being removed from little villages which are unrecognized. You see, Israel does not recognize those villages. And they literally come and destroy these little villages that are not recognized, and the Bedouin just are thrown into the desert. You know, they literally, you know, have nowhere to live. You know, the idea is to transfer them out, to make life so impossible, to limit them within boundaries and barriers and checkpoints, so that they have nowhere to go and life becomes so impossible that, you know, they leave. And that is the basis of Israeli policy, both within Israel and the West Bank.
This may be a rather unrealistic question, but are there any possibilities for peace with justice for both Palestine and Israel, well, starting off with Jerusalem, in the near future? Because I know that a lot more Israelis are beginning to think this is not Judaism and are rebelling against what the government is doing.
Well, I mean, the short answer to that is no, because, I mean, what I've explained here is that it's creating a situation of perpetual, you know, continual conflict. What Israel is doing is so against the principles of justice that, you know, it doesn't look like there's going to be peace unless peace, in a way, is forced onto them. And, of course, there are many voices, you know, that are against it. You know, there are lots of Jewish voices in this country, around the world. But within Israel itself, there are wonderful organizations like the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, you know, that each time a Palestinian house is destroyed, you know, they go in and try and rebuild it. They organize summer camps, which is worth, you know, sort of going on, you know, for the summer. And yet Israel is now bringing laws to prevent peaceful, non-violent demonstrations against the wall, against the expropriation of Palestinian land, and they're literally arresting people, you know, and saying it's against the law even to protest. You know, even non-violent protest is becoming impossible now. And just very recently, a Palestinian from the village of Bel'in, whose land is actually being taken away against even the Israeli Supreme Court decision, you know, that this wall, you know, must be taken down and moved so that it doesn't take over Palestinian land. One of the sort of main protesters has now been actually convicted and is likely to serve a prison term of 10 years. And many of the demonstrators obviously are Jewish, you know, lots of Israeli, young Israelis and various groups. But the main population of Israel is still very entrenched because the whole education system has been that, you know, the world is all against us. You know, the Holocaust is brought into the education system. So there's this almost continual paranoia, you know, that everyone's against us. If we don't, defend Israel and firm up our foothold in this country, you know, we'll be pushed into the sea. So there's a very intractable position amongst, the bulk of the Israeli population, which has shown as to why they've voted in, you know, the extreme right parties, you know, that are almost fascistic in their whole sort of aims, in driving out the Palestinian population. So it's quite a scary situation. And unfortunately, the West seems to turn a blind eye, you know, continually, and sort of seems to buckle under, you know, to what Israel is doing. And, you know, Israel has always insisted against whatever people have said. I mean, even the British government have, you know, constantly said, if you write to the Foreign Office and say, look, this is terrible, they say, we agree it's against international law. But what are you doing about it? You know, nobody, for 40 years since the occupation, Israel has managed to continue with its policies. And this is where, I think we'll discuss this in the panel, is civil society has now got to take action and start putting pressure on Israel in a very positive way, like boycotting, you know, disinvesting, from companies that actually benefit the Israeli settlement project. And, of course, Israeli, boycotting Israeli produce, which is actually grown in the Jordan Valley in illegal settlements and is actually illegal. So these are sort of bits of action that can be taken. Does that answer your question?
What I expected, I think.
Right.
I think we've got time for one more question, if anybody else has a question.
Okay, folks. Yeah. Abe has painted a very black picture concerning what is happening in Jerusalem. And indeed, it is terrible. It is urgent. The facts on the ground are changing on a daily basis. Each day, another mile of this separation barrier is being built. Each day, more homes are demolished and people evicted from their homes. Each day, more olive trees are being uprooted. Each day, people go without water and medical services, things like that. Included in this is a Christian population. It's not only a Jewish population, it's a Christian population as well that are suffering in these same ways. And so we are calling on you at this festival to respond. And Abe has alluded to that, because as we go through the festival and learn more, and we're going to be at the very end of this Focus on Palestine, be looking at what we can do and how we can respond and the best ways to respond. But in all of this, we must not lose hope. We've seen history change in the past. We've been surprised. when history has changed. We believe history will change again. And so, in a sense, I'm sorry to finish this sentence on the negative side, but we want to go through. We live in hope. We never give up on hope. And you can be part of it. So continue to join us in the other sessions that we'll be having. Abe's, the book that he contributed to is in the bookshop.
A Time to Speak Out.
So go and see that book there. Come and join us at the other events and hear Abe Haim in one of the final sessions now on the call to boycott and if we want to take that response. Let us thank Abe for coming to address us today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to me.